there were people from Europe, from Canada and the US, and then there were people from the Pacific, quite a large delegation from India. The Philippines was very excited. There was about 300 of us there.
The documentary explores what's happened in the last 20 years, how we've managed to arrive at a place where people are not as concerned about getting the virus as they once were, and where some people, a small fringe group, deliberately seek getting infection.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. High-profile hate crime cases are closed in Paris and Vancouver. Controversy and a UN rights resolution get ILGA's attention. And a challenging cinematic gift has questions about prevention. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 17, 2004. Criminal proceedings against the suspect in the near-fatal 2002 stabbing of openly gay Paris Mayor Bertrand Delanoy ended this week. A judge dismissed the criminal charges against Azzedine Berkane, declaring him mentally unfit to stand trial and ordering that he be sent to a psychiatric hospital. Three teams of psychiatrists had examined Berkane, two of them finding him unfit to stand trial. Berkane reportedly told police that he attacked Delanoy out of his antipathy towards homosexuals.
Another high-profile gay-bashing case closed in late December as the lead suspect in the 2001 killing of Vancouver, Canada gay Aaron Webster was given the maximum sentence for manslaughter. That's 3 years with at least two to be served behind bars. While many feel it's not enough, Judge Valmont Remilly took the unusual step of going beyond what prosecutors had asked for, which was only 20 to 32 months. Prosecutors were not convinced that Webster's attackers acted out of homophobia, apparently because the suspect, who cannot be named because he was a minor at the time, told them he was hunting peeping toms rather than gays. But the judge saw it differently and called it an abhorrent and heinous crime, committed with premeditation. Webster's death sparked rallies and a new level of community activism against hate violence.
The number of anti-gay attacks in the Australian state of New South Wales is essentially unchanged since a decade ago, according to a new report from the State Attorney General's Department. The report, called You Shouldn't Have to Hide to Be Safe, is based primarily on a survey of more than 600 gays and lesbians. About 85% reported experiencing homophobic abuse or violence, 56% of them within the previous 12 months. Those figures are quite close to the results of a police survey performed in 1994. The lack of progress shocked and saddened many in the state of the famous Sydney gay and lesbian Mardi Gras. The only bright spot was the increased willingness of gays and lesbians to respond to the survey.
Northern Ireland's Department of Education commissioned a survey of more than 360 lesbian, gay, and trans people under age 25 with grim results. More than 60% said they'd experienced negative attitudes toward their sexual orientation in school, with 44% experiencing outright bullying. Only about 1 in 7 of those experiencing negative attitudes had sought help, with almost 30% attempting suicide. For all the respondents, there was 5 times the rate of medication for depression and 20 times the rate of eating disorders than for students at large.
A new study of anti-gay harassment in schools was also released this week in the U.S. state of California. The state circulated a health risk survey in the 2001-2002 school year, and 237,000 teenage students responded. 7.5% of those students reported being targeted by bullies because of their actual or perceived sexual orientation. Their resulting fear led them to miss school 3 times more often than other students, and they were twice as likely to be depressed or suicidal. The California Safe Schools Coalition this week added the findings of its companion survey of more than 600 students. They found that explicit school policies against homophobic harassment, training for teachers on how to intervene, and the presence of gay-straight alliance clubs made a real difference in decreasing anti-gay incidents on campus.
Atlanta, Georgia's ordinance prohibiting sexual orientation discrimination received its first test this week as a lesbian and a gay man sought spousal privileges for their partners at a private country club. The city's Human Relations Commission held its first ever formal hearing for the complaint brought by Lee Kaiser and Randy New against the Druid Hills Golf Club, where they pay dues of $475 per month following an initial membership fee of $40,000. Spousal privileges include inheriting the membership when the member dies, as well as being able to use the golf course without additional fees. While the commission's official statement is still being drafted, the panel believes the club violated the ordinance. What's believed to be the nation's only similar case involving a country club is currently in a California appeals court.
New Jersey Governor James McGreevy this week signed into law a bill extending some limited legal recognition to same-gender domestic partners, which will go into effect in June. New Jersey is only the fifth U.S. state to formally recognize those partnerships. Primarily opening spousal benefits to the partners of state employees, the bill also creates a registry open to all gay and lesbian couples and to heterosexual couples over age 62. Registry carries some of the medical, taxation, and private insurance benefits of marriage, and discrimination based on domestic partnership status is prohibited. That status will also be granted to couples who have contracted legal partnerships in other states.
The House of Representatives of Trinidad and Tobago this week unanimously approved a revised extradition bill that protects lesbian, gay, and trans people. The bill denies extradition from Trinidad and Tobago in cases where the request is based on the individual's sex, gender, or sexual preference. The move was unusual because Trinidad and Tobago still criminalized sex between men, yet it was not contested during debate on the bill.
A gay couple in Latvia this week held what's believed to be the first same-gender wedding in the Baltic region, or at least the first known to the public. Oskars Krumans and Igars Robesis were joined in a commitment ceremony in Riga performed by Maris Sants, a pastor previously suspended by Latvia's Evangelical Lutheran Church after publicly stating his own homosexual orientation. Attending along with about 40 family and friends were reporters from Lithuania's independent television. The grooms deemed Latvia's own media too unfriendly to be present, although they'll be holding a press conference for them in the coming week. Latvia currently offers no legal recognition to same-gender couples, a situation the men hope that publicizing their relationship will help to change. Illustrating the resistance, a Latvian legislative committee working to bring national labor laws into conformance with European Union standards this week refused to include in their draft a provision to prohibit sexual orientation discrimination. But Krumans said that he expects the gay and lesbian youth support group he heads will become the Baltic region's first sexual minority organization to win official registry when Latvia's company registry considers applications in a couple of weeks.
The Vatican's global campaign against legal recognition of same-gender couples took a personal turn this week with the publication of a letter from a partnered lesbian relative of Australia's top Catholic leader, staunch conservative Cardinal George Pell. Though only Pell's second cousin once removed, Monica Hingston has a bond with him, and both she and her partner of 19 years, Peg Moran, spent most of their adult lives as nuns, offended by the Vatican's language in recent documents on homosexuality. Terms like seriously depraved and gravely immoral, Hingston felt a need to speak up. But she only went public with her letter after months of repeated failure to gain any response from Pell to it or to phone calls. In her letter, she movingly describes her relationship, calling it a rare and precious gift and life-giving. She criticizes the Vatican at length, saying, "These prelates are obsessed with how we physically show our love for each other," and notes that the same logic used against gay and lesbian couples would apply to all infertile couples. She calls the Vatican arrogant in presuming to dictate to elected officials. She asks Pell to give her a personal response from the heart and to consider what he's actually saying to people like herself. Once her letter had appeared in newspapers, Pell issued a short public statement that the church's views are well known and will not change. I support them. He added, as food for thought, a reference to the gospel verse in which Jesus said, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone."
And finally, as the Scots say in a phrase made famous by TV, there's naught as queer as folk. And now you can announce that in the legal name of a New York nonprofit group. The Department of State there this week finally greenlighted two groups to incorporate under their chosen names, Queer Awareness and Queers for Economic Justice, reversing its November decision against them just 3 weeks before a court hearing. Previously, the state had deemed the word to be indecent and degrading and therefore banned under New York's not-for-profit corporation law. Christopher Beneke founded Queer Awareness in the belief that the label is the most inclusive for non-heterosexuals, and at age 24 says he's never had any problems with the word that was once an insult. He self-identifies as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. Also a paralegal, he filed a lawsuit demanding to have the Q word in his group's legal name as part of his right to free speech. In announcing the Department of State's change of heart this week, a spokesperson said only, "After taking a closer look, it was decided that the word queer is mainstream enough that it probably won't be objectionable, so we will allow its use."
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 17, 2004. Written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
It's the thought that counts in a documentary exploring The Gift and the gay men who deliberately try to get HIV. We'll hear from the woman behind this controversial film later in the program. The Second World Conference of the International Lesbian and Gay Association, or ILGA, recently brought activists from around the globe to Manila for the first such event in Asia. Conference delegates discussed a wide range of queer issues and worked on developing a strategy for passage of a supportive resolution on sexual orientation at the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. Presented by Brazil at the Commission's last session, that resolution identifies sexual diversity as an integral part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This Way Out correspondent Uma Kali Shakti, an Australian Aboriginal lesbian, traveled to the Philippines from her home base in Sydney to attend the ILGA conference and discuss the accomplishments of the gathering and its attendant controversies with her 2SERFM Gay Waves broadcast partner, Michael Schembri, shortly after her return.
Uma, I suppose you're pretty happy to be back after a couple of hectic weeks in the Philippines.
Absolutely. It's been, well, actually, I've really enjoyed myself there. I was at the ILGA conference from the 14th to the 18th of November, and there were people from huge representation, when I say huge compared to the rest of the world, from Europe, from Canada and the US, and then there were people from the Pacific, quite a large delegation from India and a few other countries through Asia. We didn't have much representation from Latin America, and we had only two people from Zimbabwe, which was quite interesting. That was the only African representation.
Nobody from South Africa?
No, it was Zimbabwe. Nobody from South Africa,
That's
no.
Amazing.
And we covered many, many issues. We looked at ILGA and the United Nations institutions, human rights, law and governance, men and discrimination, women's issue in the LGBT movement, transgender persons, youth, rights in Asia. We had some wonderful performance evenings, which is apparently not a feature of ILGA normally, sexual politics and social justice movements, risk and romance and gay sex in the era of HIV/AIDS, strategizing. Now, I'll get back to that. LGBT in difficult environments, asylum or migration, coming out together, the role of friends and family, LGBT issues in the trade unions, achieving same-sex marriage through legislation. We had a wonderful torch parade, so the Philippines was very excited. There was about 300 of us there, and 200 to 300 people who went through the conference. So at any one time, I would say there was about 200. And so it was a very international torch parade night. We looked at gender, health and AIDS, culture, family and religion, bisexual issues, theatres for advocacy, South to South, LGBT issues in the newer nations of LGBT countries, visible pride, pride as advocacy, media, friend or foe. So as you can see, there was
like
a huge amount. But I think probably the most important thing was the Brazilian resolution, the next 25 years of activism. We had Claudia Roth, MP and Human Rights Commissioner in the Foreign Office from Germany there, and she gave a fantastic closing address. And we had, as I said, strategizing for the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, including the Brazilian resolution.
Right.
And basically that's Brazil has brought to the United Nations a resolution about changing the laws to do with sexuality.
And that's because of the new government.
That's
the
right.
Workers
and
Party.
In fact, it's caught everyone on the hop. We had a Brazilian rep who got there very late at the conference for various reasons. And he said even the local LGBT organisations there were completely startled when this happened, you know, it just came completely off-centre, if you see what I mean, and no one knew that was going to happen. Even ILGA was caught short. They had a 25-year plan to get it in. So we're all very excited. Australia is one of the countries that's going, is part of the group that's going to be there. And what we want to try and do is agitate for all the other countries that may be able to support the countries that are actually going to be involved in getting this resolution up.
Excellent. Now, with 300 people, so many organisations, so many countries, so much politics, there must be controversy.
There was a bit of controversy, and it was actually, unfortunately, to do with local politics. There'd been some kind of fallout, and we came from overseas and didn't know about this fallout. And one morning, we were woken up at 6. It was, in fact, the first day of the conference. And people had some people had travelled 25 hours or more, but we were woken up at 6 and told we had to be at the conference, even though it wasn't starting till 9, and that we couldn't disturb the local jeepney drivers who were waiting for us, and we were taken there. We sat and waited till 11. Some people got sick of it and went shopping, and I was told that there was a little conference nearby of some of the local LGBT groups, and would I like to go? And I thought, well, I'm not doing anything here, and I went. But later we got into enormous trouble for having dared to go to this other conference. And the reality was, and I think there's been some stuff on the internet already, there were some local LGBT groups who could not afford to come to this conference, which was held at a hugely expensive hotel in town, something equivalent to the Sydney listeners would know, Menzies, and the cost was enormous. I mean, I didn't know what the costs were because I went as a scholarship person, and it actually cut out a lot of the local people. And so we got a chance to meet with the local people, but there was some frowning on us doing that.
The organising body seems to be made up of a bunch of wankers, really.
Well, no, it was more that the local organising group had a fallout, but what they did, which was really stupid, was they actually involved us for, you know, overseas people who didn't know anything about it. They should have just been really open. We hadn't done anything wrong. We met with the local groups who actually didn't say a word about ILGA or the organising committee. We just spoke with them, and I think that was a bad mistake, and it left us with quite a bad feeling in the mouth, especially as some of us who had gone to this other conference without knowing were then stalked, or we felt stalked for the rest of the conference. People kept trying to find out where we were at all times. The major thing, I think, for me was the absolute revelation that really homophobia comes from the West and from the colonisers. As we got together, as we get together internationally, it becomes more and more clear that actually prior to that there wasn't a major issue in our cultures, and that many are left with a legacy of colonial governments and colonial mentality and laws that aren't necessarily always used against us, but are on the books. And if for any other political reason, if any of us are activists, not necessarily just around sexuality issues, but other things, so the government can use the law, existing homophobic laws, against us.
That was Uma Kali Shakti talking with Michael Schembri about the recent 22nd World Conference of the International Lesbian and Gay Association.
There's nothing so international as a powerful idea. Hi, I'm Edmund White. While I live in Paris and have worked in many cities in the U.S., it is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful and impressive over the past couple of decades. And one radio program, This Way Out, has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine on this station.
Just the news that the documentary was in production ignited a rhetorical firestorm over a year ago. The Gift examines bug chasers, barebacking, and the failure of HIV/AIDS prevention efforts in the gay community. Producer-director Louise Hogarth is used to the heat, and her documentary has collected critical acclaim and international film festival awards. What makes The Gift the most controversial HIV/AIDS film yet? This Way Out correspondents Chris Allen and Mark Armstrong sat down with Hogarth to get some answers.
Louise, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about the premise of the documentary, The Gift.
The documentary explores what's happened in the last 20 years, how we've managed to arrive at a place where people are not as concerned about getting the virus as they once were, and where some people, a small fringe group, but some people actually deliberately seek getting infection from what is called a gift giver, and they would give the gift of HIV to a bug chaser.
Why did you decide to make a film about this controversial subject in the first place?
Quite honestly, it was made from a lot of love. It was made because I've seen a lot of suffering, I've lost a lot of friends, and I want the pain to stop. And it was made with the help of a lot of people who were very altruistic and who contributed their time and their effort in order to get this film produced because they thought that it would accomplish something good. And it would hopefully relaunch a prevention effort which is targeted for where we have now arrived, which is very far from where we started. Our prevention strategies were initially targeted with what we thought was going to be a short-term health crisis. And because it was short-term, we embraced people that had the disease, we made it okay to have the disease, and unfortunately we need to still embrace people who have the disease, but we have to make it a positive thing to be negative.
What has been the reaction?
I've had a very good reaction. I don't think that the documentary is sensational. There's no blame and shame. It does explore the issue of people barebacking, which is having sex without a condom. Many people are barebacking without thinking about the issues of HIV because they don't really realize what it means to get HIV. People who have seen the film think it's a compassionate look at the problem. It is intended to relaunch a new kind of prevention movement.
Was it difficult to find people to participate in this project?
Strangely enough, it was not at all difficult.
Really?
Not at all. I found two young men who were both bug chasers. A bug chaser is a person who's HIV negative, who seeks to become HIV positive, and he does this by finding an individual who's willing to give him what is called the gift of HIV, and that person is a gift giver.
Well, can you tell us the story of a particular bug chaser you have in your film?
Yeah, there's a young man named Doug who's in my film who at 19 years old moved to San Francisco in search of a community. You know, he wasn't buff, he wasn't into the club scene, he was too young to get into the bars, he wanted to have friends, gay men, and he found that the easiest way to be accepted was to participate in bareback sex. And he also said that no one in San Francisco is concerned with safe sex any longer, that mainly it's a don't ask, don't tell. If you would go to a party, if you were to reveal your status, you were asked to leave. So many people are not bug chasers, but there is a large majority of people who are barebacking, who are having unprotected sex. This particularly occurs on the internet. The internet is kind of the new gay bar, and it's easy to find a hookup. You can just get online, find what you want, and hook up or go to a party. There's parties everywhere. I could find you a party right now in this neighborhood.
And that's how you found the people for the film?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, no, Doug I found because he wrote an article for Paws magazine. And Kenny I found on the internet.
This whole situation is really hard for me to believe. I've just, you know, it's come into my awareness that people are actively going out and searching to become HIV positive. What's the rationale behind it? Why do this?
The biggest thing that you hear is that they don't want to worry about it anymore. It's almost become intrinsic to be gay is to be HIV positive. That is a fringe group that's deliberately becoming positive, but it's not a fringe group that's participating in risky sex. I don't know the numbers, but that is, if you go on the internet, that's an amazing number of people, and it's all over the world. You can find a party in Taiwan, in Germany, in Africa, in Los Angeles. It's an international phenomenon. I'm not saying gift-giving. Gift-giving is just a fringe movement, but the bigger problem is people that don't realize what it means to get HIV. We realize what it means to get lung cancer. Doug told me he would never smoke because he saw those ads and they scared him to death. But there aren't any ads that scare people about HIV. The ads that we see from the drug companies, people look very healthy. They look very buff. You don't see any information coming out of the gay community either that it's a very serious disease. There's no discussion of side effects. And we don't see all the people that are dying of heart attacks, liver, kidney. Now people are having hip replacements due to the drugs. Projectile diarrhea, vomiting, nausea, sleep deprivation, nightmares. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And plus what's happening now is people are becoming immune to the drugs. The virus is mutating.
So I guess I'm still having trouble digesting all this. You're saying that this gift-giving element is fairly small, but a very large percentage of gay men are out there barebacking at these parties where it is said that you are not allowed to ask somebody's HIV status. When you go into these parties, that's part of the whole...
Well, I think when you go to one of these parties, you assume that everyone is HIV positive, which allows you to bareback, because I think the thinking is, I'm already HIV positive, what can be worse? So, but unfortunately, there is something worse, which is, if I have the disease and I bareback with somebody who's had the disease for a much longer time than I've had it and have taken all of the cocktails and have immune to several of the different classes, I can get his HIV. So you can have more than one strain of HIV. And this is a very controversial issue, and a lot of the doctors in the gay community say this is not true. But at the last AIDS conference in Barcelona, they did prove it was true. And I interviewed somebody, and this is in my documentary, and he had three or four friends who were okay. They were living with the virus. They barebacked. They contracted another more stronger strain of the virus, and they died.
Louise, to me, this is all very shocking. What is it that you feel, given all that you've learned about gifting, about barebacking, what do we need to be doing as a community to deal with this issue?
I think we have to promote being negative. One of the people that I interviewed said, wouldn't it be a great idea to have a man on a poster saying, I've been HIV negative for 20 years. It hasn't been easy, but I'm still negative. I mean, you would never have a gay man stand up in a room and say, I've been HIV negative for 20 years, because that would be insulting to the people that are positive and it would hurt their feelings. We have to promote being negative, and we have to rethink our prevention strategies. As a community, we thought it was a short-term health crisis. It's become a long-term health crisis. We need to develop new strategies in order to prevent HIV infection.
So in other words, the culture that we've created has, in your opinion, to a large part, helped create the situation.
Dr. Walter Detz is featured in my documentary. He wrote, in the shadow of the epidemic, being HIV negative in the age of AIDS. Most of the information that I have obtained comes from him. He told me that it's really the gay community that has normalized it to be HIV positive and has normalized transmission of the infection. Our strategies when we embrace people, which was great and wonderful for the time, has now backfired on us, and we have to be brave enough to rise to the occasion and prevent young people like Doug in my documentary, who at 19 years old became HIV infected and now has already burned through one class of the drugs. Now he's on his second class. He's 21 years old and he's dealing with a horrific disease with a lot of side effects.
That was Louise Hogarth, producer-director of The Gift, in conversation with Chris Allen and Mark Armstrong. The Gift will have its world broadcast premiere on the U.S. Sundance Channel on February 2nd. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Graham Underhill, Fensberry, Rex Walkner, Michael Schembri, and Uma Kali Shakti, and Chris Allen and Mark Armstrong contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. And now you can get our keepsake Movies, Music, and News 2003 Year-in-Review programs on CD by helping us stay on the air. For all the details, please log on to thiswayout.org. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 2BAY Byron Bay, New South Wales, WMNF Tampa, Florida, KXCI Tucson, Arizona, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Please stay tuned.